Okay.
Well, yeah. Okay, I'm Anthony Lee. I'm from the University of Nottingham. I'm talking to you today about some work about introducing a finite spatial profile to unmoved weight detectors. So it has a lot of overlap with things that have been talked today about localization of modes, detectors, what happens when you put sizes in things. It's all good stuff. Yeah, it's been in collaboration with my supervisor, Yvette, who unfortunately isn't here today. So I'll hopefully say everything she wants me to say. But yeah, let's just get started. I don't have too much time. So I'll just start off with talking about the two trajectories that I'm going to be talking about today. So I'm going to consider, in particular, stationary or in principle inertial, because it extends immediately to that, and accelerated. But just to recap on what inertial trajectory is, you all know, so I'll go through it very briefly. It's the simplest kind of trajectory that we can think about in flat space time, so I'm sticking to flat space time, that's all. In particular, what's going to be very important for the talk today is some notion of rigidity of detector. So I'm thinking about an unmoved detector that's not point-like. So it's got some spatial extent, so you could think about it as a cavity, say. You could have a little cavity that has a particle in it described by the Schrodinger equation. For instance, this is not what I'm going to do, but you could think about it like that. But if you start accelerating it, does the notion of, is it rigid? When you're if you're moving with a detector, do you describe the same size? Because when you're in the lab or something like that, something that would be nice is if you can say that your detector doesn't have to change in size. Maybe you want it, so that's fine, but for our purposes, I don't want it to change in time when it's moving through the space-time. So for inertial trajectory, this is obviously no problem. Nothing diverges with you if you have two sides of the detector and they're moving at the same velocity, constant velocity. The sides of the detector won't move or anything like that. But if you're accelerated, this could change. In particular, it does. If you're inertial and you're watching an accelerated trajectory, the size of the cavity, if you're thinking about that, will change from your perspective. But as you'll see, from a co-moving observer with co-moving with the accelerating trajectory, the accelerating cavity, then it will actually stay constant, and that's a special consequence of Rindle coordinates, and not a general thing.
And in particular, just to mention that there's no spontaneous transitions for these detectors, so that's going to we're going to come up with that later on, which I'll explain a bit more. But just to give you a flavour of what's going on, inertial, in particular, stationary trajectories are pretty bland, nothing too crazy happens, so
as you'd expect.
So the other type of trajectory is uniformly accelerated trajectory. I've only drawn the right Rindle equation. We've seen explanations of what Rindle coordinates are and things earlier, so I'm not going to stay on this too much. And this is a particular set of coordinates you can use to describe Rindle space-time. You can use the conformal ones in particular for the calculations I do later. I do use the conformal coordinates, but those details aren't too important. But they're just some Rindle coordinates here. And this is a uniformly accelerated trajectory. So this is one world line for somebody who says that we've got a fixed acceleration when a fixed proper time. Well, his proper time varies, but it's his proper time. And what follows is that if you think these coordinates, these chi and eta, parameterize the right Rindle wedge, and you can think about them parameterizing the right Rindle wedge by a family of curves, each having a different proper acceleration and therefore a different proper time, but all curved together are enough to describe all the points in the right Rindle wedge, which is important for us because that would put in a trajectory, a cavity with some profile on the right Rindle wedge. So, and that's also useful for the conformal coordinates, and the conformal coordinates do show this as well. And just to cap it off, the standard result for an unmoved weight detector travelling through on a uniformly accelerated trajectory is that it sees a thermal bath, the well-celebrated Unruh effect. And we'll see how putting a spatial profile changes this result. Not drastically, but it's interesting to see how it's modified in exactly the same way as Andrea was talking about. If you allow finite time detections and you actually have to pick out a mode and allow time for this, you get a modified unmoved spectrum in some sense of the temperature. We find similar result here, but from a different angle. So let's go on to the actual detector model that I'm talking about. So the model was initially talked about by Takagi in his seminal 1986 paper. And what he does is he says, well, let's consider the interaction between a monopole detector, could be a two-level system, could be more, but we consider a two-level system here, interacting with a scalar field that's living in the space-time. So we're considering a real scalar field, massive or massless, it doesn't matter, the results hold for both. And this is written in some appropriate interaction picture. So obviously with it being an action, it's an integral over all the space-time coordinates. With it being space-time coordinates, we can choose to parameterize the interaction how we want. So you normally pick it to be some useful coordinates. If you're in spherical geometry, you pick spherical coordinates and things like this. So we're going to exploit that to write down our detectors. So that's the overview. So that's the action for anything. That doesn't matter what trajectory is going on, what field is going on. That is the basic interaction that we're going to be considering. In particular, I'll be choosing a model such that I can factorize the detector. So this is the whole monopole detector model that I'm using. It's factorized into two pieces. A time-dependent piece that depends on some parameter tau.
I haven't said what that is, but I will get onto it.
And this is an operator, this is a monopole operator. And this purely functional piece, which is a parameter of some coordinate y, which again is a coordinate that I'll choose to be most convenient. It's going to parameterize my space-time and parameterize my detector's profile. So it's up to me which one I want to choose, which is the best for the job. I'll just mention that this metric just comes in because it's a coordinate transformation, of course. If you're in four dimensions, then you have more infinitesimal pieces here. And this, instead of being one coordinate, will be many,
a few more.
So, but for 1 plus 1, this is the simplest, just a illustration. We have some kind of temporal coordinate, and we have a spatial coordinate. And in particular, we parameterize our field by these coordinates as well. And we'll also explore different expansions in different modes. So in particular, expanding the field in Minkowski and Rindler modes, and then parameterizing them by appropriate coordinates. But if you use this expansion, if you believe me, if you can say such a thing as I can factorize my monopole moment into a spatial profile and a detector part, which again comes down to this notion of rigidity. If you have a rigid detector, then you can say that the spatial profile, as with someone co-moving with the detector, doesn't change. So that's the reason I said that I can factorize it. You can take all the spatial dependent parts, shuffle it along, and put it into the integral over y over the field, and then you just have your integral over d tau and your monopole piece interacting with whatever this object is. And we'll interpret this as a smeared field operator. So this is just a standard field operator living in your space-time, whatever you want it to be, parameterized by some coordinates. And now this will, once you perform the integral over y, will be a function of the field operators and whatever this temporal coordinate is.
And that will say it's some smeared field detector. So it can, in particular, it will be limited in the frequencies that you integrate over. And we'll see that.
This, you'll just bear with me, just take it as a given. But depending on what mode expansion you define, so if you say that you want to expand it in terms of Minkowski modes, you'll get some Minkowski operators and so Minkowski modes. And this guy, tilde, is going to be, for the Minkowski case, for a stationary detector, just a simple Fourier transform of the old function, root g of f of y. But if you use different modes, obviously a massive field, say, or a field that's in more dimensions, then this isn't going to be a simple Fourier transform anymore, because the spatial parts of the Rindler modes, or Unruh modes if you want to use them, aren't simple exponentials, just like a standard Fourier transform. In fact, they could be Bessel functions, which is it's a good integral transformation if you want. It reminds you of a Hankel function, a Hankel transformation, but it's not going to have exactly the same properties, depending on what mode expansion you do. But this is going to be the general form of the interactions. So now moving on. The next important component is in the transition. So I'll briefly run through this because I only have a limited amount of time, but it was this form of the transition rate which on the detector, which is telling us some kind of physical quantity of how often the detector is clicking per unit time as it's travelling through a space-time. That's what this is, so it's basically a time derivative of a probability of being excited. That's the physical interpretation here. It's definitely defined like this, and I won't go into the derivation, but the most important piece of that is the Whiteman function here, which is defined as the two-point correlation function of the field. This field now is a smeared field that I was talking about before, so we've done the integration over the Y component, and we've now just got the power dependent thing here, so we've smeared out our field, and size whatever state we want the field to be in particular, we'll be looking at vacuum transition rate, so which is a standard calculation, so what happens when an accelerated detector goes through the Minkowski vacuum, and also we'll look at if you plot one particle in whose state, if that's the kind of thing that you gets you off and you want to do that, that's what we'll do. So, I'll just briefly run through Minkowski, the different field expansions that you can do for these guys. So here's a standard scale field living in your space-time. In particular, this is a 1 plus 1 case, massive. We have a standard decomposition here. We've got the normal Minkowski operators and the normal Minkowski modes. These modes are defined as this, and they're globally defined, as we say. I know we've been saying that Unruh modes are strange things because they're global modes, but Minkowski ones are a bit strange as well because they're global, but I must admit I like Minkowski modes more than Unruh modes. And this is a particular form in this particular dimension, and obviously you can extend this to 3 plus 1 if you wanted. And that in particular, here's a mass, and that allows you to integral over all of K. If it was 1 plus 1 massless, then obviously you're going to have a mass term here and be an integral from 0 to infinity, which is absolutely going to be important for what happens when you're coupling, which I'll explain later. But like I said before, if you can remember back to my smeared operator, field operator, this F tilde in this particular case, for these particular coordinates, once you've picked your appropriate coordinates that you want to parameterize by, which in this particular case, you want some coordinates that describe your space-time as an inertial observer, the perfectly good corners for that, I mean Minkowski corners, so we'll stick with that. All I do is I just change the x to some dummy variable y, and this is all you need. And so, and in particular, the smearing function that you get is just Fourier transform of this f of y, the special profile that you gave the detector. And in the previous slides, I also assumed that this transformation was even in k. The F tilde is even in K, which just gives a simple forming principle. There's no need for that. But if you're considering purely real even functions F of Y, which I will be, then the Fourier transform is a purely real even function in K as well. So. Next is the Windle modes. Again, I won't bore you with this because I'm showing you all these details, but we can decompose it into the right Windle wedge by a plus sign, so here's a dimensionless Windle frequency. And this is the right-hand side. Same Minkowski coordinates. All I'm doing is expanding the same field in the same space-time, so I can expand it in terms of Minkowski coordinates. It was shown a long time ago that you can use Windle modes and Minkowski modes to describe the same field in the same space-time. Just one's more appropriate for accelerated guys and one's more appropriate for inertial guys. So this is the standard Minkowski coordinates. And here's the denoting left Windle wedge across the emission conjugate. And in particular, for the 1 plus 1 massive field, which you can also do massless, or adding massive, just to illustrate that what the smearing is going to be later is going to be very different from a Fourier transform. Is it so? In terms of the Minkowski coordinates, these are the Unruh modes. So here you get these phases that go with the logarithm or something. And in particular, here's a modified Bessel function of the second kind. Here's the dimension of the Windle frequency, and here's the Minkowski coordinate, m being the mass of the field, of course. So, this is where it starts getting a lot different.
Sorry.
I forgot to mention as well. So, this has been done by me in a bit, but
quite independently. Work by Eduardo
Miguel and
another Spanish student, Marcos Del Rey, who's unfortunately not here.
They've
been doing similar things as well, but not.
They're considering how a detector couples to the Minkowski modes. We're more interested in transition rates, they're interested in probability rates and things like that, so I put that as a, in the previous slide, there was a reference to their work that would be coming out, so I just thought I'd like to highlight that. So, but here we can see the F tilde for the Windermere expansion now is drastically different from the Minkowski one. We've now got an integral transformation of a modified Bessel function, which isn't, although being fine, it hasn't got all the well-known properties that you'd expect it to. Well, personally, I don't know what all the properties are. I don't know what the shifting theorem is and things like this. But Fourier transform, okay, we've known that for a long time, and we know what the transformation properties are. So if anything, if you want to couple the different modes, you need to, so the shifting property of the Fourier transform tells you that if you want to transform a function and on the other side shift it in momentum, you need to introduce a phase and things like this. And details about this and the problems that can arise in terms of the physics is going to be in Eduardo Miguel's and Marcus's work. But we don't focus too much on that. We were more interested in what the transition rates are. So, but just to note, in the small mass limit, then this is obviously going to reduce to the massless Windler modes. But we know that because in 1 plus 1 dimensions, conformally, the Windler modes and Minkowski modes are exactly the same. So all you're getting the massless case is again an appropriate Fourier transform. So you can expect somewhere, when m is very small and this is approximately a Fourier transform, you'd expect similar kind of properties to hold for whatever you want. So in particular, we'd like our smearing function to be peaked around some particular mode, because that's maybe what you don't want to peak around. You want to put a peak around the desired mode. So you need to introduce, like I was saying, the phase here, but we want F to be real still. So introducing a complex phase here will break in F will break the emissionness of the action. So to compensate for that, you need to add the complex conjugate, which is either so that makes a phase plus its complex conjugate is either going to give you a cosine or a sine. And which also has consequences in the sense that if you've now got a cosine, so you do say you put a cosine here, and you have a Fourier transform here for the modified Bessel functions, if you take the cosine and take the Fourier transform of it, that's going to give you two delta functions, one for positive momentum and one for negative momentum. But that means that our field then, if that's going to give you two delta functions, and that goes back into a little bit. If you put that into where f tilde is here, if this is the sum of two delta functions, this integral will pick out two momentum. So for free fields, you can't actually pick out one particular momentum that you want to couple around. You have to pick two. And that comes from the realness and introducing these two complex phases. But that, again, I don't want to go into too much detail. Just last thing. We've heard about the Windermere mode, so I'll blitz through these. Here's a definition in terms of Minkowski coordinates. So here's the right Windermere wedge, the left Windermere wedge. And this hyperbolic trig things. Functions are related by this half parameter, which is defined by this relation. The only reason I want to talk about these is that the Windermere modes actually make the calculation for working out the transition rates incredibly trivial. They've got the great properties, like Jason was saying, that they share the same vacuum as the Minkowski coordinates, but they're in some sense one-to-one correspondence with a Windler frequency. Well, you need to be careful when you say that, but that's what Jason was saying. And I'll just point out that on the right, because the Windermere modes have support everywhere, they're defined in terms of left and right modes, so they're defined, they've got support everywhere. On the right, you don't have a vanishing, the Windermere left and right mode expansion will mean that not only do you have this problem where you peak two modes from the Fourier transform properties, you actually peak to both unroofed modes as well, so we can't, it's sort of a Minkowski mode, ignoring that you peak into two modes, you can couple to a single momentum that you want. This goes for a Windermere expansion as well. But for the Unruh, it happens to be that if you try and couple to one particular Unruh mode, you just can't do it. You have to couple to both of them. You have to couple to both left and right Unruh modes, which is quite surprising. But that's just the way that it worked out. And that comes from this global definition of the Unruh modes themselves. So let's just get on and look at the vacuum transition rate for these newly smeared field operators. So we'll go, because we're wanting to look at the vacuum, we insert the Minkowski vacuum here,
which is the most natural thing. If you're in flat space time, you're going to expect that there's the Minkowski vacuum there.
And we wanted to work out this Wideman function that
I told you about earlier that goes into the transition rate of the detector.
And this is what you find.
So I'll draw out the key points here.
So this is the expression for this instantaneous transition rate,
which I told you is some kind of quantity telling you how often the detector clicks as it's traveling through the space time.
It's got the standard form, if you're aware of these things, the standard form of what you'd expect in brief is inertial accelerated. So here you can see distinctively the thermal signature of the accelerated trajectory. But you see that this Fourier transform or Bessel transform or whatever you want of this F has crept in. And not only that, it's the modulus squared, but because we're considering real functions, it's just the squared. So this is along the lines of what Andre and Jason were saying, that we see modifications to the thermal spectrum when you're introducing a size to the detector, just in the same sense as if you introduce a time for detection, you're getting modifications to the temperature. And this is exactly the same thing you're going to see here. So if you say that your detector does have some spatial extent, you're not going to see exactly a spatial profile. Okay, so I'm moving on. We got onto the single unruly particle. If you put the single unruly particle on, you get exactly what you did before, except here's the Wideman function of the previous vacuum exchange rate, and here's a new modification due to the particle being there, and it takes this particular form. You see that the smearing is coming to play. This is some normalization for your state, if you want it. And this new comes from the unruly modes that you've defined. So let's cut to the chase. So the most important property is that the instantaneous transition rate given by this expression is new contribution term.
Because you put an unruly particle there, is that it has an oscillatory part.
So you get the vacuum expectation
plus an
oscillatory part. The main property that you want to take away from this
plus or minus infinity, there's no contribution for this particle ever being there, so you don't know it was there. But in the intermediate places, you have an oscillatory contribution from the one particle there. So your detector really does see the one particle state, and it does have an effective contribution. So I'll just quickly wrap up.
So that's right. We looked at putting it in spatial extents and profiles of detectors.
The main things that we want to take away from this is that we can construct Hamiltonians where we can couple an unruly weight detector to particular modes, but it really just depends on what you're doing. If you're accelerating the modes that you couple to, you might couple to Rinlon modes or unruly modes, but you might have to couple to lots of things. So you need to take into account what you're actually wanting to do.
And we also saw that the transition rates are the usual
transition rates of the detector as they're going through the space-time, but when you put a spatial profile in there, you have to modify the thermal spectrum that you would see if you were accelerated by the Fourier transform of the spatial profile. And so as soon as I'm out of time, I'll cut it there and just say thank you very much for listening.